The word savvy actually was a variation of the word savant. And as I've been rereading the book Range recently, the book Range actually goes deep into the concept of what a savant is, S-A-V-A-N-T. A savant is someone with deep or obsessive knowledge in an area. That was a savant. So, you know, many of you, and probably like myself, we are on the road to being basketball savants, to having deep and obsessive knowledge about a certain area or skill. Now, here's the thing. When you're a savant, well, then you become savvy. So that's the variation of it. And so that's really what we're on a mission to do here at Savvy Coaching, is to serve basketball savants, to give you some insight into other basketball savants so that you can become more savvy, so that you can be smarter, have deep knowledge of an area. And one thing that I will always stay committed to is that it's more than just the X's and O's. A savvy coach does more than just have the knowledge. A savvy coach is a master teacher of the knowledge. A savvy coach is one that knows that leading humans is what leads to success, achievement, and growth. And I think that's really where probably most coaches fall down. If you think about, you know, the different aspects of being a coach, and if we just simply broke it into three areas, if like area one was just knowledge, right? If area two was ability to teach that knowledge, being a master teacher, and if area three was the ability to lead humans, if you could only pick one of those three areas to be world class in, and let's say that you had a team of athletes and you wanted that to be as successful as it could possibly be in a given season, but you can only pick one of those areas. You could only have a coach that had great knowledge, but couldn't teach it and couldn't lead people. How successful do you think that team would be? Or you had a coach that was a great teacher, but didn't have the knowledge and couldn't lead people, couldn't inspire and encourage and empower them. Or the third coach, great leader of people, not much basketball knowledge and not a great teacher of any, you know, system or skill. Which of those three coaches do you think would likely get the most out of their team? Now, you know, the answer is often in things like this, it depends, but I'll share with you my answer. I would go with the great leader 10 times out of 10, 10 times out of 10. And we've seen this at every level. I mean, there are highly, highly successful coaches that aren't necessarily the basketball knowledge guru. There are highly, highly successful coaches that don't have great teaching methods, but they're great leaders of people. And so when you think about being a savvy coach, or you think about being a coach at all, what would be a savvy or smart way to go about improving? I think oftentimes too little attention is given to becoming a great leader. So all that being said, I'm going to dive into what I would talk about is the I and savvy, the identity, who you're committed to becoming. And what's beautiful about this life and about, honestly, this profession is you get to create and recreate your identity daily. And one aspect that I would encourage you to focus more on with your study and your reading, with your journaling, with your focus, your intent, with your practice and what you exercise, is grow yourself as a leader, even more than you just grow your knowledge or grow yourself as a teacher. I would also be really interested to hear, you know, what would be another primary area of coaching, as those are the three main buckets that came to mind for me, which is knowledge, teaching, and leading. What else? What else is there as a primary bucket? Okay, let's dive in today with continuing to build out your identity as a savvy coach. And I think based on the definition that I offered, I think all coaches would be hard pressed to not want to be more savvy. What are you doing if you're not trying to become a savant in this thing that you're passionate about? And I'll say this as well. You will get more joy and fulfillment investing in yourself than you will get consuming for yourself. Let me say that again. You will get more joy and fulfillment investing in yourself than you will out of consuming for yourself. So when you think about your time, your energy, and your treasure as you go through this life, you know, so often we either invest those things or we spend those things. And when we spend those things, we spend them on consumption. So we'll spend time, energy, or treasure on, you know, a great meal or an experience or a product or a thing. Or you can use your time, energy, and treasure to invest in those things that really make your heart sing. And I think most of you are choosing to coach, like the challenge, the journey of competing to win and grow and solve the puzzle and pour into people and help people grow. That's what makes your heart sing. So if there's anything in life, whether it be your physical health, whether it be your business, whether it be your coaching, I believe you'll get more joy out of investing in the best to grow in that passion, as opposed to buy another car, have another meal, whatever. And I'm reminded of that myself as well, as I'm on a journey in outside of coaching right now in the next skill that I'm trying to acquire. And you'll rarely go wrong investing in yourself. So that's kind of an encouragement and a long-winded way to say I appreciate that you're choosing to invest with us here at Savvy Coaching, as we are committed to continuing to invest in you, in learning, in sharing what we learn, and putting it into bite-sized portions that you can apply right away, especially in the midst of your busy life, in the midst of your busy season. All right. How can you become a better leader, regardless of knowledge and teaching ability, if you choose to make that a part of your identity? An interesting study was done at the Harvard School of Business, where all these high achievers had to do a group project. But what these business students did not know is that while they thought they were learning business and doing a group project, they were actually a part of a psychology experiment. And here's what happened. The Department of Psychology actually chose to embed, to plant what they called an EOR into each team of four business students that had this multi-week business project. And the EOR's only job was to just be a downer, to disagree with every idea, to be exasperated, to be frustrated, to be low energy, to be very reluctant to help, and to just generally be a wet blanket on whatever idea, regardless of the validity of the idea, whatever idea that the students had. Now, there were a couple of control groups where they did not embed an EOR. And so at the end of this multi-week project, there were very similar ideas and business plans between groups that had an EOR and that did not have an EOR. And what they found was the greatest indicator of the success of the group, the success of the business plan, and the grade that the group got on the project had very little to do with what they chose to do. It had very little to do with how they chose to do it, and had the most to do with whether or not they had an EOR on the team. Whether or not they operated with joy was the greatest indicator of success. The same is true for your team. And as we go back full circle to what I said at the beginning, if we broke coaching up into these three categories, like knowledge, ability to teach, and ability to lead. These groups had all the knowledge that was the same. They had the same teaching from the teacher and whatnot, but the only difference was, did they have leadership that raised the level of joy in the group or lowered the level of joy? And I offer this up to you today as a savvy principle. Have a team that plays with joy. And when you have a team that plays with joy, I guarantee two things are going to happen. First and most importantly, you and the team that you're leading will enjoy the experience more and have a more fulfilling life, which is most important. But secondarily, and not to be overlooked, your team will perform better. In fact, I would argue that whether or not your team plays with joy will have a greater impact on your success, your win-loss record, your achievement, than any system you choose to put in, whether you're racing and spacing, locking left, doing whatever, than any skill development you do, or even your ability to teach the game. 10 times out of 10, I would choose a soccer coach that knows nothing about basketball, but is an amazing leader and builder of joy to coach a basketball team, than a basketball coach with all the knowledge and all the teaching, but that does not know how to lead a group of people 10 times out of 10, and they would probably be successful. So what are you focusing on, especially as you get to this point in the season where you kind of got what you got as far as players, where you've already kind of built your house for your systems. You can make some refinements, but you're not going to tear it down and rebuild. This is what it is. So can you just get your team to play with more joy? So how do you do it? Here are three actionable tips that you can go and implement right away that will help encourage your team to play with more joy, because the team that plays with joy plays harder, they play faster, and they play better. Number one, and this is actually the best tip that I've ever given players to help them make a free throw in the moment. Tip number one, just smile more. Physically smiling creates a more relaxed body. A more relaxed body shoots better. Across the board, a relaxed body is going to help players perform better. But specifically in shooting, a tight body has never made someone a better shooter. A relaxed body has always made someone a better shooter. And one of the best ways to relax the body is just to smile. So I've used this in free throws, I've used it in shooting development. It's just like, okay, smile through your release. I mean, use your legs will not help a tight shooter make a free throw. Okay, or freeze your finish will not help a tight shooter make a free throw. But smiling, which is something you can focus on, more than you can focus on relaxing your body, will help a shooter make a free throw, will help a shooter shoot better across the board. Now, when frustration creeps in, it leads to a tighter body. When anger creeps in, it leads to a tighter body. When fear creeps in, it leads to a tighter body. Whereas if you can just use triggers to play with joy, which is smile, this is fun, we love what we're doing, we'll allow them to play with joy. That's one. Two. Remind players of why they're there, and that will help them play with more joy and refocus their attention from what might be frustrating or angering them to what makes them happy. Let me give an example. I had a new player come and train with me last night. Very, very athletic, naturally, skill set raw. And when I was asking this player to do challenging things, they were making a lot of mistakes. The mistakes led to a lot of frustration on the face and tightness. That tightness led to, guess what? More mistakes. So I said, whoa, okay, stop. I said, all right, why are you here? Why did you choose to come train today? Obvious answer. We all know it. I came to get better. Okay, cool. All right, you came to get better. So now, over the last 5 minutes, here's the question. This is one way that you can refocus players. So over the last 5 minutes, what have you gotten better at, right? And it took a while. Like, they didn't have an answer. They said they had to think about it. So we just waited. Like, I've actually gotten better at playing wider and lower. I'm like, that's good. right? Now, if I had said, how are you shooting? Or if I had said, like, have you mastered this skill? That would direct their attention to something that would not create joy. But instead I said, what did you get better at? And then they're like, oh, I'm here to get better. There's a thing I got better at that makes me happier. I said, that's awesome. You're doing great. So over the next 5 minutes, let's see if you can just get better at covering more ground on your first dribble, right? Pick something that's associated with why they're here. If they're here to make shots, then we'd be doing something completely different. If they were here to show off what they are good at, well, then we would be doing something completely different. But that's not why they were there. They were there to get better. And most of the time, that's what most players and most people would actually say. So the same thing with the team, okay? Why are we here today, right? Are we here as a team for you individual player to get a whole bunch of buckets? No, that's not why we're here at practice today, right? Why we're here at practice today is to whatever, define it. And then ask questions, say, are we getting better at that thing? So one way to get teams or players to play with more joy is to remind them constantly of why they're here and then ask them if we're getting better at that thing or how we're getting better at that thing or what we should improve on that thing, as opposed to constantly pointing out where we're falling short. That's another way to get a team to play with more joy and to refocus their attention on what actually brings them joy as well. Third actionable tip. Remind yourself or your team about what they love about the game. So I would just ask you, you know, if you're watching this live or if you're watching this recorded, you as a coach right now, what is it that you love about the game of basketball? I mean, one thing that I love about the game of basketball is change. I love seeing a player or a team change, go from where they were to closer to where they're trying to be. I love that. I love growth. That pumps me up. And basketball is a very simple and small place. Within 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, you can see change. It's hard to see change in life. It's hard to see growth. But basketball, you can see it quickly, and I love that. Okay, what else do you love about the game? Gosh, I love seeing a team work together. Right? I just love it. I love seeing a team become more than their individual parts when they actually work together. I love seeing players grow in confidence and be more aggressive as opposed to being fearful. I love that, right? I love all those things. I love helping people as a coach. I love helping people. If a player wants to, you know, become more successful as a shooter and I can help him do that faster, I feel valued. Yeah, I love that. Okay, so what do you love about the game? Well, that whole process actually got me more excited about the next time I get to serve in a gym, in a classroom, whatever, teaching. If you were to go through that process with your players once a week when it's needed in the middle of practice, in a pre-practice, and just have them share or journal what they love about the game, it will direct their folks to what they love, and they will then play with more gratitude and joy the next time they step on the court. And as we know, joy leads to success. So that's a leadership tactic and a leadership skill. There was nothing there about X's and O's. There was nothing there about how to, you know, teach a jump shot, like knowledge of teaching, shooting or finishing or a dribble move, okay? That was everything about leading a group to perform better. Let me do a quick recap. Three actionable tips that you can use to lead your team to play with more joy today. One, remind them to smile. Oh, and remind yourself to smile a little bit more as well. Smile through the frustration, smile through the mess. Two, remind your team of why they're there. And then ask questions about why they're there. So if why they are there is to get more physically fit, ask them if they feel like they got more physically fit today, right? The question is the answer. And then lastly, remind yourself of what you love about the game. Ask your players, remind them of what they love about the game. Do it regularly, do it often, and your team will play with more joy. I'm gonna shift into a little bit of film breakdown right now. And and the film breakdown is going to be specific to a team that's running a lot of lock left out of a zone, actually. What I would ask all coaches, and this coach in particular, is what is your goal of your defense? Are you achieving that goal? Are you progressing in that direction? If not, do you need to make any sort of a change to the goal of your defense? So, for example, if the goal of your defense is you want to speed up the offense and create a lot of turnovers, then are you doing that? If not, maybe you need to adjust the goal. As much as we often look to adjust our methods and the processes, a lot of times, especially this late in the season, if we're not achieving the outcome that we want, maybe we just need to change the outcome. And the outcome, when in doubt, zoom out, the outcome will then help you determine if you need to change your methods. So let's go and check this out here. And if you aren't a lock left team, or you aren't running a lot of lock left right now, then maybe you can sign off right now. All right, so we've got this team in white here, run lock left. So what we're seeing here is a lot of pressure. Okay, so this is the first thing that we look at. So we have a lot of pressure. We're picking up full court. We're trying to speed it up, right? So I would then ask this first question, why? Are you trying to generate offense? Are you trying to, do you believe you've got an athletic advantage? Do they have a really good half court offense trying to get them out of? Do you feel like you're going to be able to turn them over? Like, we're picking up really high. And on the ball, we're applying a good amount of on-ball pressure, right? So, I mean, as I'm watching these clips, and I've watched them already, I'm not seeing a lot of turnovers being generated. I'm seeing, you know, we're creating some difficult shots for the opponent, which is good, but I'm not seeing us generate a whole lot of turnovers. And so if we're not generating turnovers out of this, the question I would ask, and if on the flip side, we are giving up penetration, right? Like this, we're getting beat and giving up penetration that's compromising our defense. Then I would say, okay, let's reassess the level of pressure that we're applying. The general rule would be, we want to, on the ball, lock them left and apply an amount of pressure where we do not get beat right and we don't give up blow bys left. So here's a scenario where we're getting beat right, right? So this is a player that's happened to twice now in a short period of time. So I would say, okay, and even just given their stance with the angle of their feet, their stance with their nose being out over their toes, right? He's playing on his toes a lot. We don't want an on-ball defender to play on their toes. When an on-ball defender is playing on their toes, they're going to be really jumpy. They're going to be getting off balance a lot. They're actually easy to beat. We want an on-ball defender that's planted, right? Planted where their nose is between their toes. They're not leaning off balance. An off-balance on-ball defender is easy to beat. So that's actually one of the first indicators that I look at to determine, okay, is this someone that we want to put on the ball a lot? And I'm already seeing with this defender right now, is they need to be taught how to not play on their toes. And until they can change that, I wouldn't put them on the ball very much. So again, you know, a contested shot at the rim, solid. But I don't know that we're necessarily wanting to play with this level of pressure. Okay, we have a little less pressure. So I'm seeing the same defender on the ball. Good length and, you know, maybe a relatively fast player. But even just like on the ball right now, how squared up he is, we're giving up a little too much. You can see that they're running this out of an extended 2-3 scenario. That's a shot we don't want to give up, an off the catch three. And I would even say this is pretty uncontested as he gets the ball above his eyes before we're in his space. A bit of a late contest. So if I'm watching this team, I think two two initial pieces. All right, this player on the ball here has a better stance. You can see he doesn't play on his toes quite as much. I like his stance. I like his angle. He's able to keep that ball left and keep it in jail. Now, even in this, we've done what we want here. So I wouldn't put a level of pressure, especially without the support. He's kind of on an island out there. I wouldn't put this level of pressure on unless we are down. Right, there we go. He gets to be left. So that level of pressure now has compromised our defense. It's gotten going downhill. I think we've already done our job right here. He's done a nice job right here. He's got him left. Now we want to give a little bit more space and buffer to keep the ball on the left-hand side of the floor. And so this is really all coming back to on-ball defense. And I wouldn't even worry about our off-ball defense until we get better at our point of attack. This is why we make people go left instead of right. They do a pretty good job contesting at the rim. Contested layup going to his left. That's a tough shot. So that was good. All right, we're extended and picking up full again here. Let's see once they get it in how we do. Okay, so basically we went from a set defense situation here, where it's a dead ball sideline inbounds, to we then gave the opponent a transition opportunity. So why would we want to do that? Well, I think one would only want to do that if you believe that they don't play as well in chaos as you do. I think you'd only want to do that if you're down at the end of the game. I think you'd only want to do that if that is going to be your identity across the board. We get back to neutral here pretty good, but most of these on-ball defenders are playing on their toes. You'll see it here again. Boom, right there, playing on their toes. Against a live dribble, stay in your stance. Like, you do not have to rise up out of your stance against a live dribble to contest the shot. All you have to do is learn how to stay in your stance and press in a little bit closer to the ball handler. If you're coming out of your stance against a live dribble ball handler, then either you're not yet a very good defender or they're an offensive player that you're not gonna stop anyway because they're so good shooting off the dribble, which is just super rare at the high school level. Here again, you can see I think the main goal I would have for this team in white here would be lots of on-ball stance and balance training. They're playing on their toes a lot. You can even see with this on-ball defender now, his nose is out in front of his toes. When your nose is in front of your toes, you're about to get beat because you're not going to be able to recover because your weight is towards the ball handler. And when you run towards the ball handler, you become a falling domino, or you're basically putting yourself in a constant closeout situation. Yeah, I mean, we can't do anything on the ball until we improve our on-ball stance. Hips down, chest up, weight balanced, hands tight, ready to move. I'll go ahead and give just a little bit of feedback on our off-ball defense here. I know whenever I'm assessing a defensive team, I always assess from ball back because the ball is the point of attack. If we can't dictate where the ball goes, we can't load up help. And right now we're not able to really dictate where the ball goes. So regardless of if you're in a man-to-man or zone in this scenario, we want to be playing the same way. We want to be on the ball, next to the ball, or on the wall. So right now we have two players that are next to the basketball offensively, right? The two closest players ball. This player is next to the ball, and this player is next to the ball. And I'm fine with both of this position. So next to the ball to the left, gap, solid. Man or zone, doesn't matter. Okay. Next to the ball here, I would like him a little bit higher to make sure that we cannot allow that pass. Just a little three-quarter deny. He could still be chest to the ball even with this left hand in the passing lane, or he could go three-quarter kind of high post with the right hand in the passing lane, but we need to be in contact. Where we're having troubles on the wall here, 14 is in a useless position. He is not in position to stop a dribble and layup, nor does he have good vision. Same thing here. This player is in a useless position. We need both these players on the wall because they're not next to the ball. So this player would be probably high wall, and 14 here would be low wall, and he would be in the smile. If we're not in those positions, then we're not in a position to stop a dribble and layup. You see, there's nothing at the rim right now. I would say that our gap was probably in the gap too long and too late. The on-ball defender, because of his stance, gets beat left, which really, really compromises us. As soon as we get here, boom, As soon as the ball handler gets their shoulders by the defender, the gap defender has a decision to make. And the decision is skirmish or scram. He's either deciding, all right, is this ball handler more dangerous going to the rim? Or is this corner player more dangerous catching and shooting? And, you know, I would tend towards not helping off corner shooters, but I would allow players to start to make a decision based on if they're a shooter or a non-shooter. We don't want to give wide open layups, especially for good ball handlers, right? So right here is our skirmish or scram decision. Skirmish would be a quick fake and sprint out to the corner. A scram would be go ahead and show your chest and make a peel switch with the on-ball defender because the on-ball defender is beat. And the on-ball defender peels off the back, scrams off his back into the corner. What's the wrong decision? No decision, which is what we have here. We have no decision. There's not a skirmish or a scram decision, right? We're just standing there, and then we get into a long closeout situation. That long closeout situation gets him up out of his stance. You know, we could work on closeouts all day, sprint and sits. And if you're going to fly, you've got to fly to the right ear to make him go left, because that's where your help is loaded up, or should be. 14 should still be at the nail. We have no stance on the wall here, right? So this is all just individual player skills. This is not an X's and O's issue yet. This is individual player habits, our stance on the ball and our stance off the ball. You can't move quickly from our stance that we have right now. And so we get compromised, give a right hand drive. Fortunately, the offense has poor spacing and they don't get a big benefit from it. But all of those things remain true. Now this is much better on ball defense, a little bit toes, knees over toes, but he's in much better of a stance. He sits here. He makes him go left, shooting off the dribble, pull up. Great. Once he rises up, then the defense can rise up. The defense will only jump second, will only jump after the offense jumps. And that's much better. That's a pretty good erase right here on the rebound. Good job. Way to go erase first on the rebound. Excellent. And then the ball bounces to him. So that's kind of the checklist of how I would evaluate a defense. How do we play at the point of attack on the ball? How do we play next to the ball? How do we play on the wall? Regardless of man or zone, every defense is a man on the ball. And every defense is a zone off the ball. And so there really is no difference based on how, it really just is a difference based on how you match up in transition and who you're matching up with throughout the possession. So hopefully that helps give you a little bit more context. I look forward to any ongoing questions on this. And Coach, I'll send you a full video breakdown on this one as well. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of an idea. All right, until next time, I'm Tyler. We're here to help, coach, and play with joy. Lean into leadership. As often, it's not an X's and O's problem. It's often not a teaching problem. It might just be a need to lead your team with more joy. We'll see you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.